Good afternoon, everyone. The Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on public House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic,
which it stands,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund?
Present.
Vice Chair Zhang? Representative Detmer?
Detmer present.
Representative McDonald?
McDonald present.
Representative Berg?
Present.
Representative Bliss?
Present.
Representative Edelson?
Present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Greenman?
Present.
Representative Nelson? Representative Poston?
Present.
Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh present.
Representative Sundin? Representative Sundin? I think you're muted, Representative Sundin.
Present. You muted me.
Representative Zhang? Representative Nelson? And we do have a quorum.
Quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from March 19th, 2021. Every member should have received a copy of today's minutes in their inbox. Representative Frederick, would you care to move the minutes?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frederick moves the approval of the minutes from March 19th, 2021. Any comments or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The minutes are adopted. First bill on the agenda today is House File 2284 from Representative Berg. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move my bill.
Representative Berg moves that House File 2284 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Berg, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill essentially requires that carbon monoxide detectors are placed in every room in a hotel, motel, or lodging house, not X amount of feet away from each room, but every room in which there is the intent to sleep in. And this bill is basically about safety. You know, I, outside of this job, I'm a flight attendant. Chair Eklund's son is a pilot for the same airline I work for. I stay in hotels for a living. And there have been many days where I've woken up and I felt lethargic or achy or had a headache. And I just figured, well, I've been in seven different time zones in the last 4 days. This is just normal. But after hearing the story from my testifier, who will be sharing her story in a few minutes, I began to wonder how many times was I exposed to small or even large doses of carbon monoxide. And so when we look at this bill, when you hear the testimony today, you know, think about friends or family members or neighbors that stay in hotels due to work, or your family takes a vacation, you stay in a hotel. This is the opportunity to save lives. We have the support of the Department of Public Safety on this bill. We will be doing some amendments with them, but we have their full support. And so I would like to turn the time over to my testifier.
Thank you, Representative Berg. The testifier, Leslie Lineman. Ms. Lineman, please, if I got your name wrong, I apologize. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Leslie Lineman.
Thank you, Ms. Lineman. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund and the committee. I do appreciate the time that you've allowed to hear my story, and I'd like to talk a little bit in summary. I provided a great deal of information to the committee before the hearing because I'm, of course, passionate about this issue, having nearly lost my life and the life of my son to carbon monoxide poisoning in a hotel. And I won't tell you, I won't go in detail through my story, but what I have learned from this experience is that there is a lack of documentation and therefore a lack of understanding in the public and a lack of understanding even in the hotel industry of how common carbon monoxide leaks in hotel actually are. You know, one of the hardest things for me to realize is that my son placed his trust in me and I brought him to a hotel and brought him back to the hotel each night, not knowing that he was being poisoned. And as I was informed in the hospital that we had suffered carbon monoxide poisoning, I thought to myself, how could this happen? How is it that there was not a carbon monoxide detector in the hotel room? I subsequently learned that there had been previous carbon monoxide incidents in the same hotel, but the law in Michigan did not require the installation of carbon monoxide detectors. And I wondered whether that was a requirement federally or in Minnesota. And to my horror, I learned it's not. I'm asking this committee and this legislature to make Minnesota a leader on this issue, because what I have learned is that hotel carbon monoxide leaks are common, that they are not required to report to be reported, that emergency personnel are not required to report carbon monoxide leaks or even injuries. And so the prevalence of this is hidden from the public, just as the poison gas was hidden from me in that hotel room. But I have been able to cobble together, through the help of the Jenkins Foundation, which exists because the parents of the woman who founded the foundation lost their lives in a hotel carbon monoxide incident, and because a child died in the same room 6 weeks later because of the lack of transparency about carbon monoxide poisoning in that hotel. And the information that I've been able to gather indicates that thousands of injuries occur due to carbon monoxide poisoning in hotels, hundreds of deaths. You'll see in the materials I provided that in the state of Minnesota alone in 2018, there are 12 documented carbon monoxide leaks in Minnesota hotels that have been reported, but those were reported by fire departments who did not identify the hotels and did not document any injuries. Since being injured in this hotel, I have begun carrying a carbon monoxide detector with me at all times. And since 2019, on two occasions in Minnesota hotels, that carbon monoxide detector has alerted me to elevated levels of carbon monoxide. In both of those hotels in Minnesota, there were not carbon monoxide detectors that went off. One incident, we determined that the cause of the carbon monoxide was a pickup truck that had backed in so that his exhaust was pumping directly into our room, and we were able to solve that problem by simply asking him to turn off his truck. The second incident, however, because my personal carbon monoxide detector went off and the parts per million were accelerating according to my detector, I alerted the hotel and I left the hotel. I know that emergency personnel were called because I saw them outside later. I don't know the cause of that leak, and I don't know whether it was reported. I'm sharing this information because I know that carbon monoxide leaks happen here in Minnesota. They aren't documented. There are so many tragedies that occur that we can't predict and we can't prevent. Carbon monoxide poisoning is entirely preventable. All it takes is a carbon monoxide detector to tell you to leave the room. Had there been a carbon monoxide detector in that room on day one, we wouldn't have stayed through day one. We wouldn't have stayed for day two. We wouldn't have stayed for day three. And we wouldn't have suffered the extremely high levels of carbon monoxide poisoning that we did. Perhaps more importantly, maybe not, when we got to the emergency room, I would have been able to relate to the emergency personnel that we were exposed to carbon monoxide. But I didn't have that information, and so it took another hour before we were given proper treatment. I believe that the only opposition to this bill could be that it will cost money, that hotels will have to install carbon monoxide detectors. And so I thought about that over the last 2.5 years as my son and I have struggled to recover. You can go to any hardware store and pay retail price and get a carbon monoxide detector for $15 or $30. There are just under 1,000 hotels in the state of Minnesota. A carbon monoxide detector costs, let's say, $30, or lasts about 5 years. Even if you multiply that cost by 10,
carbon monoxide.
Even if you multiply that cost by 10 to include installation, the cost of installing a carbon monoxide detector is mere pennies per night per room, balanced against the life of my son or someone else's son. That's nothing. And I would like you to just think back to the last time that you stayed in the hotel and think of all of the amenities that are provided for your comfort. A hairdryer, a coffee maker, a television, an alarm clock, complimentary coffee in the hotel. All of these amenities that are provided for your comfort cost a hotel more than it would cost to protect the lives of yourself, your son, your loved ones in any hotel. This is not simply an issue of safety for me or for my children, but many people travel for work, so it is a labor question. This bill would protect the people who work in the hospitality industry because every hotel, of course, where there's a carbon monoxide leak, there are employees breathing carbon monoxide. And in the labor context, that's particularly important because what we suffered was called acute carbon monoxide poisoning, which means we were exposed to a large amount of carbon monoxide in a short amount of time. But chronic carbon monoxide poisoning is equally damaging. That is, if you're in an environment for a long period of time, even when there are small leaks. And so this is a serious issue for occupational safety as well. I feel as though this is my watch. Most Americans, most Minnesotans don't know that they are in danger of not waking up when they check into a hotel. But I know it, and you know it now because I've told you. And to those folks who would say that this is the cost that the hotel industry can't bear, I'd like you to consider the example I gave you earlier of the couple, the Jenkins, who died in the hotel, and the little boy who died 6 months later, 6 weeks later in that same hotel. That was a Best Western property. After those three deaths, the Best Western Corporation franchise required that all of its hotels install carbon monoxide detectors in each individual hotel room. It did not put them out of business. And it didn't put them out of the business for the reasons that I've just explained. That hotels spend far more money per day on simple comforts, adding this small expense to save the lives of employees and travelers is not going to put any hotel out of business, but it is going to save a life. And so I'm asking you to help Minnesota be a leader on this issue to protect my son and your children and your family members and your employees from carbon monoxide poisoning. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lehneman, for your testimony. Please stick around if you can in case there's member questions. Members, any questions on House File 2284? Representative Edelson's hand raised function is not working. She texted me, so Representative Edelson, you can go first.
Thank you, Chair. And yeah, I knew why my hand raised function was not working. I want to thank you for this bill, Representative Ferg. And this is like a little emotional for me. Sophia's Law was passed before I ran for office. And I don't know if any of you members that have been here for quite a long time would remember. Sophia was the name of my best friend's daughter. And she, I was on the boat with them on Lake Minnetonka, and she died of carbon monoxide poisoning. And I will never forget what that felt like to not be able to save her. And And I know that the debate at the Capitol, when my dear friend, who's a cardiologist, who was her mom, came to the Capitol to fight for that. People thought of many different reasons that it wouldn't work. And now today, when you buy a boat and you have a boat, a carbon monoxide monitor is required. And thank goodness for that, because it will save another Sophia. And there will be no other Sophia, but it will save another child. And I remember pulling into the dock, not knowing what happened, and people on Lake Minnetonka jumping out to save her. We as legislators are tasked to do the right thing, to be preventative. And I think if anybody knew that day when we got on that boat that that would happen, we would have done whatever we could to stop it. And so, Representative Berg, I could not be more supportive of this. I'm adding my name to it as we talk. And I just thank you. I thank you for carrying this.
Is there any other member questions? Representative Edelson, I remember well the debate on Sophia's Law. I was the one that worked on helping tighten that law up as it came to dealing with the requirements for the carbon monoxide detectors in boats and houseboats and that sort of thing. It's a terrific law. It needed to be done. And I'm glad you brought it up so I don't have to talk anymore about it, because it was an emotional time for all of us. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be supporting this bill. And just a couple questions, though. Do the carbon monoxide alarms, do they have to be hardwired, or can they be batteried? This is for the author.
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Detmer for the question. They can be battery.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you. And how many other states have passed this law now already to require carbon monoxide alarms detectors in hotels?
Representative Berg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Detmer for the question. I will pass that question over to my testifiers. I'm not entirely sure, but I do want to take just a moment to note that this issue has been brought to the federal level by Congresswoman Angie Craig from the 2nd District. It is called the Safe Stay Act in Congress. So this is not just a Minnesota, we're trying to accomplish that here, but it is also being recognized on the federal level. And so I will defer that question to my testifier.
Okay. Ms. Lehman, if you have the answer for how many states have enacted this.
Thank you. I believe that I do. I did a review at the time of the poisoning, 2019. There are very few, most states don't regulate this at all. There are a few states that have some form of requirement. There are none who require them in each individual hotel room. And I really encourage you to do it this way. And I'd like to explain a little bit more about what happened in the hotel room where we were. We now know that there were two sources of carbon monoxide that day. One was a water heater that was in the maintenance closet across the hall from our room. The other secondary source was a semi-truck that was allowed to run in the hotel parking lot adjacent to our room. And despite the fact that the carbon monoxide was coming from across the hall, there were no alarms. And so this is an aggressive bill, but it is also one that will accomplish the goal. And I can tell you, had there been a carbon monoxide detector in the hall, it wouldn't have saved us that night. So if your goal is to prevent carbon monoxide injury, please lead the nation with this bill, because this bill will accomplish that goal.
Thank you, Ms. Lehman. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you to the author for bringing it forward. I don't know, is there any place in your language that says that these batteries need to be replaced during a certain interval? I know in our home, they're replaced when those beeps go off, or even once a year. So maybe that's something that you might want to consider in your language.
Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that, Representative Detmer. My goal is for there to be every enforceable language, every little detail perfected in this bill, even down to how often and how soon the batteries need to be changed, so that people don't have to experience what our testifier has been through. Thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, I have a lot of appreciation for your efforts on this. I plan on supporting the bill, but I do have a question to the chair. Now, Chair Eklund, I know you have a hunting cabin up in the North Woods, as do I, and a lot of other people do. Do you have a carbon monoxide detector in your hunting cabin?
Representative Sundin, yes, I do. Now that I finally joined the 21st century, I actually have an outlet that I can plug it into, so I don't have to rely on batteries as well.
Well, just for the edification of the committee and others, you can purchase these detectors anywhere from $20 to $120. Some of them are battery operated, some are hardwired, and I'm going to get one for my hunting cabin as well. So, thank you.
Any other member questions? Representative Byrd, one recommendation I would have is work with the Department of Labor and Industry about maybe getting this into code for new construction as well, so that they can be hardwired in, so we don't have to, the management would not have to worry about replacing batteries as well. Final comments, Representative Byrd.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great point. We are actually, as I mentioned in my introduction, working with the full support of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. We are working on some amendments and some language so that this is as enforceable and as permanent as we can possibly make it. Full disclosure, Ms. Lieneman is a dear friend of mine. When I was considering running and I had some insecurities and some concerns, and am I the right person to do this? And I don't know. And I had a conversation with her, and she told me, you need to run because my son needs you. And that brings me to tears in most situations that I tell this story. But in no way during that conversation did we know that this would come to pass. And so it is with a great amount of emotion and honor that I carry this bill. For her, for her son, for my sons, and your family members, I just ask you members to support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Byrd renews her motion that House File 2284 be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Committee. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Aye.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Detmer votes aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Byrd.
Aye.
Byrd, aye. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson. Representative Poston.
Aye.
And aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Nelson. There are 12 ayes and 0 nays.
12 ayes, 0 nays. Representative Byrd, you're on your way to public safety. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2253 from Representative Sundin. Representative Sundin, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2253. It's a Workman's Comp Advisory Council bill. With me today, I have Commissioner Roberts from the Department of Labor and Industry to testify on the bill. This is the product of cooperation between parties, and that would the parties would be labor, insurance interests and Chamber of Commerce and the Department of Labor as well. So this is a culmination of some of their technical fixes and the one extension of the presumptive language that we heard from Representative Wolgamon. So with that, I'll leave it to the commissioner to testify and explain the bill in detail.
Representative Sundin moves that House File 2253 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Sundin, we do have an author's amendment, the A21 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment and explain it?
Just include the amendment, and the commissioner will explain. So I move the amendment.
All right. Representative Sundin moves the A21 amendment. All those in favor of adopting the A21, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oh, say aye. Nay. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Commissioner Robertson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rosalyn Robertson. I am the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. To begin, I'd like to thank Chairman Eklund and the members of the committee. I am pleased to be here today to speak in support of House File 2253. I want to thank Representative Sundin for carrying the bill and for his support and participation on the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. As Representative Sundin mentioned, the bill before you today represents the work undertaken by the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council over the last several months. The Advisory Council held 5 public meetings in December, January, February, and March, during which it received written and public comments on the proposals included in this bill. The department revised the proposals based on public comment and recommendations made by the council. The council passed these recommendations with unanimous support at its March 10th meeting, and therefore the bill has the full agreement of both business and labor. As committee members may know, the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council has a statutory charge to review and submit its recommendations to the legislature each year on proposed amendments to Chapter 176, the Workers' Compensation Statute. The Workers' Compensation System supports employers, insurers, medical and rehab providers, and most importantly, injured workers to ensure employees injured on the job receive the benefits and services they need to recover from an injury and return to employment. The Advisory Council includes the presidents of the largest statewide Minnesota business and labor organizations, as well as 5 members representing business and 5 additional members representing organized labor, as appointed by the governor, the majority leader of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, the minority leader of the Senate, and the minority leader of the House. The Advisory Council may not recommend proposed legislation unless it is supported by the majority of the employer members and a majority of the labor members. Because of this process, the Advisory Council bill is generally respected by the legislature and proceeds without amendment. However, the amendment that was adopted today was a grammatical clarification that was brought to our attention by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and after the Advisory Council had agreed to the recommended overall language. The amendment was discussed with and agreed to by the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Members should have a copy or a summary of House File 2253, but I would like to briefly describe the provisions. Section 1 of the bill updates the minimum weekly compensation rate for temporary total disability. The current minimum benefit level, which was last updated in the year 2000, is the lesser of the employee's actual weekly wage, or $130. This language sets the benefit level at the lesser of 20% of the maximum compensation rate, or the employee's actual weekly wage. The annual change for the minimum compensation rate will then be determined by the statewide average weekly wage, the same as the change used for maximum temporary total disability benefits. Section 2 of the bill, starting on line 4.7, adds a new subdivision to Section 176.136 that allows the department to assess a penalty against a healthcare provider who bills an injured worker for treatment, which is prohibited by the workers' compensation law. This language also authorizes the commissioner to order the provider to reimburse employee costs and expenses incurred because of the violation. The department receives these complaints after workers' compensation insurers or employees have told the provider that the bill should be sent to the insurer, and the provider has continued to try to collect from the employee. Providers have sent employees to collections, have filed claims in conciliation court, and have even attached employees' tax refunds. Sometimes employees pay the bill. The language requires prior notice to the provider of the law and who the insurer is before labor and industry can assess a penalty and any associated costs or expenses can be assessed. Sections 3 and 4, starting on line 6.4, update the workers' compensation fee schedule statute for payment of inpatient hospital fees in Minnesota statute section 176.1362 to require use of a new Medicare web-based calculator to calculate the maximum fee inpatient hospital treatment for discharges on or after October 1st, 2021. Medicare is currently phasing out the existing downloadable pricing tools, which is currently used to calculate inpatient hospital payments under the statute, in favor of a web-based calculator. Therefore, the statute needs to be updated to reflect this change made by Medicare. Section 5 through 7, starting on line 7.29, update the Ambulatory Surgical Center, or ASC, payment statute in section 176.1363 to provide technical changes. DLI published a study in January on the impact of the ASC statute, including the timeliness and accuracy of ASC payments. The changes in these sections were recommended to improve payment accuracy based on the results of that study. Specifically, the language describes the multiple surgical procedure billing requirements as opposed to referencing Medicare regulations. It clarifies when payment to the ASC is based on actual charges instead of fee schedule amounts, and it deletes inapplicable cross-references and phrases. Section 8 and 9 revises Section 176.194 which sets out prohibited conduct by workers' compensation insurers and other payers and their adjusters and third-party administrators who act on the payer's behalf. The statute provides for warnings and penalties for payers who engage in prohibited conduct. The changes clarify that it is a prohibited practice for a payer to fail to pay or deny medical bills within 45 days after the receipt of all information requested from medical providers if the requested information is necessary to make a payment determination. This is added because sometimes the information requested is not required to be provided under the workers' compensation law, and therefore the lack of information is not a valid reason to deny payment. Section 10, starting on line 12.16, revises Minnesota Statute 176.223, which required the department to issue an annual report on how often payers pay or deny benefits within the statutory deadlines. This report will now be based on data for each claim that the payers file in Workers' Compensation Campus, the department new technology system. Because Campus just went live on November 2nd, the language delays the first annual report until March of 2022. The language also allowed the commissioner to exclude incomplete or unreliable data and require workers' compensation payers to electronically file corrected data in Campus by February 15th for the data to be reflected in the annual report. Finally, the language provides that the reports do not need to be sent individually to payers because they can now see their information in Campus. Section 13, starting on line 13.13, updates Minnesota Statute 176.351 to prohibit subpoenas of the Department of Labor and Industry employees unless the department is a party to the claim or enforcement actions or provide vocational rehabilitation services to an injured worker. This section is needed because labor and industry employees from all of the workers' compensation units, including the workers' compensation ombudsman, the help desk staff, the compliance, and the alternative dispute resolution staff, receive calls from employees, employers, insurers, healthcare providers, rehabilitation providers, interveners, and attorneys who have questions about the workers' compensation law and its procedures. Under Minnesota Statute 176.261, the department is required to try to settle problems of employees and employers who contact labor and industry for help. The new language in this section is in response to a subpoena received by a department employee from an attorney. The attorney wanted the employee to testify in a deposition about a question the attorney had asked the department employee related to the workers' compensation law and rules. The department was successful in objecting to the subpoena, but only after litigating it at the Office of Administrative Hearing. Allowing department employees to be subpoenaed will limit our ability to provide information and assistance to callers and users of the workers' compensation system. Finally, Section 12 of the bill, starting on line 13.27, extends the sunset date of the current workers' compensation COVID presumption statute, Minnesota Statute 176.011, Subdivision 15, from May 1st, 2021 to 11:59 on December 31st, 2021. It provides, as does the current presumption statute, that once sunset, the employee is still entitled to claim workers' compensation for contracting work-related COVID-19, but as with other injuries and illnesses, the employee is no longer entitled to the presumption that the disease was work-related. That concludes my prepared comments relating to House File 2253, and I'd be happy to address any questions that the committee have.
Thank you, Commissioner Robertson. Any member questions on House File 2253? Seeing none, Chair Sundin, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a good bill to take care of our workman's comp issues. I appreciate the hard work that you and your committee have put in on this. And any closing comments? Chair Sundin, you might be muted again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank the committee for hearing the bill, and I'd just like to renew my motion and ask for support from the committee to move this to the
motion. Representative Sundin renews his motion that House File 2253, as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. Ms. Doyle, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Eklund, aye. Vice Chair Zhang.
Aye.
Zhang, aye. Representative Detmer.
Detmer votes aye.
Detmer, aye. Representative McDonald.
All right, McDonald, aye.
McDonald, aye. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Bliss. Representative Bliss.
Aye.
Bliss, aye. Representative Edelson.
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
Aye.
Poston, aye. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. There are 13 ayes, 0 nays.
13 ayes and 0 nays. Your bill's on its way to Ways and Means, Chair Sundin. Members, today we have Commissioner Robertson back after testifying. Hopefully she caught a breath here from the Department of Labor and Industry to do an overview summary of their budget request and supplemental request. Commissioner, welcome back, and you may begin. Oh, you're muted, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Rosalyn Robertson. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for having me here to present an overview of the governor's budget recommendations for the Department of Labor and Industry. We do have a PowerPoint that we'll be sharing with you. Thanks, Kate. First slide. Next. So just as a reminder, the Department of Labor and Industry's mission is to ensure Minnesota work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe. The department's mission is to be a trusted resource and an impartial regulator for employers, employees, property owners, and other stakeholders. The department is comprised of four major program areas, including the Workers' Compensation Division, Minnesota OSHA, Apprenticeship, Construction Code and Licensing. We also have the Labor Standards Unit, We have a dual training pipeline and youth skill training. And of course, we have our general support units. Next. Labor and industry-based budget for fiscal year 22-23 is $223 million. Of the $223 million base budget, only $9.89 million is general fund, which supports the labor standards, pipeline, and IT modernization. The majority of the funding comes from the workers' compensation and the construction code fund. This pie chart shows expenditures by program. Workers' compensation and construction code and licensing division are the largest expenditure areas, accounting for more than 50% of fund spend, of total spending. Next. Now we'll discuss changes to the governor's budget change items for labor and industry. Next. The governor proposed 14 budget items and it withdrew one budget item impacting labor and industry. The largest request is fee reduction for construction code and licensing fees and permits. $4 million, or about 2% of the agency budget requests, are for ongoing increases to the department-based budget. FTEs would increase by 23.8 FTEs in fiscal year 22 and 28.1 FTEs ongoing. The IT modernization reduction change item was withdrawn in the supplemental budget to ensure the agency can finalize upgrades to the IT system that began losing vendor support this past January. I'll present the details of the 14 governor DLI governor recommendations in the following slides. Next. The governor proposes an operating increase for the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Program, or Minnesota OSHA. The increase would fund an additional 9.5 FTEs to maintain a state program as effective as federal OSHA. This is a request to maintain current services and to add additional staff to handle the increase in stakeholder inquiries, complaints, and assistance. Increasing the number of safety and health investigators will enable Minnesota OSHA to maintain its mission to protect workers at private and public work sites within Minnesota and prevent workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. The ongoing $903,000 represent a 21.7% increase in the state appropriated funding. Minnesota OSHA has seen a considerable decline in FTEs from 75 positions in 2012 to 62 FTEs in 2020, putting the program at risk of being at least as effective and hindering Minnesota OSHA ability to effectively meet its statutory obligations. Next. The governor proposes legislation to raise the maximum penalty for willful, repeat, serious, non-serious, failure to correct and posting violation of workplace safety standards to conform with federal law. It also would tie future penalties to the Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bloomington, Minnesota, Wisconsin Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers of the CPI. The increase in total penalties will vary from year to year, but on average, the change represent a 2% increase in penalties. This proposal will make the state penalty maximum comparable to federal and other state program penalty maximums. If Minnesota does not make this change, it may lose federal OSHA funding. Losing federal funding would result in the state forfeiting its OSHA administration back to the Federal Department of Labor. Then the higher federal penalties would go into effect without the mitigating factors that Minnesota OSHA currently applies. This change would also result in 750,000 state and local government employees not having OSHA coverage. Next. The governor recommends a reduction of 203,000 to fiscal year 21 general fund operating appropriation and additional funding of 51,000 in fiscal year 22 and 101,000 in subsequent years from the general fund to maintain the current level of service delivery at the Department of Labor and Industry. This represents a 1.1 increase in fiscal year 22 and 2.2 increase in fiscal year 23 out of the general fund. The fiscal year 21 operating reduction amount reflects the savings generated due to the state hiring freeze and other operating efficiencies in the current year. The operating increases recommended in fiscal year 22 and 23 fund a portion of the projected cost increase in the upcoming biennium. Each year, the cost of doing business rises, including growing costs for employer-paid health contributions and other salary and compensation-related costs. Other operating costs like rent and lease, fuels and utilities, IT and legal services all continue to grow. The cost growth put pressure on the agency operating budgets that have remained flat from year to year without enacted increases. Next. The governor proposes to extend the fee reduction that were enacted in law in 2015 and extended in 2017. This includes license fees for construction contractors, electricians, plumbers, high-pressure pipe fitters, boiler operators, as well as building permits and plan review fees. Extending the fee reductions will allow individual and business licensees to continue paying less while providing sufficient revenues to the department to cover program costs. The proposed extension is for 2 years to determine how the economic recovery is impacting the construction industry. Extending the fee reduction would result in revenue decrease of approximately $2,250,000 in fiscal year 22 and 23. The Construction Code and Licensing Division has sought to keep its fees in line with the cost of providing service for which the fees are paid. Construction Code and Licensing Division revenues is highly dependent on the health of the construction industry. If the construction industry slows considerably, the revenue from the reduced fees is not sufficient to sustain the vital services provided, Therefore, the proposal is to extend the fee reduction for 2 years to assess fees again in another 2 years. Next. The governor recommends increasing the frequency of contractor recovery payout and the amount of funds available to homeowners who suffered a financial loss due to a licensed contractor fraudulent, deceptive, or dishonest practices. The proposal is to raise the maximum payout limit per licensed residential building contractor from $300,000 to $800,000, thus minimizing the chance that a homeowner's claim would have to be prorated. The increased cap will result in an estimated limit fund payouts to once a year on a homeowner's recovery. If an owner misses a June deadline for recovery in July, they will not receive compensation from the contractor recovery fund for almost a year and a half. Changing the payout and application deadline to occur within the same fiscal year will also result in a more straightforward way to manage the fund. There are times when multiple owners and lessees against a single contractor exceed the cap. In these instances, the commissioner must prorate the claim, resulting in them receiving far less than the amount of their out-of-pocket loss. Increasing the maximum payout per licensee will allow for more homeowners to more closely recover their out-of-pocket loss when a licensee failed to perform their contractual obligations. Next. The governor proposed expanding access to unpaid pregnancy and parenting leave, school conference and activity leave, accrued sick leave benefits for the care of relatives and safety leave, and pregnancy accommodation laws. The changes strengthen Minnesota law to ensure more workers have access to this unpaid time off and pregnancy accommodation in the workplace. $84,000 in fiscal year 22 would be for outreach and education of employers and employees on the law change, and $34,000 ongoing for enforcement and compliance activities. The $34,000 ongoing increase represents a 1% increase to the Labor Standards Division, which enforce all labor laws. The Family Medical Leave Act, or FMLA, applies to employees who work for an employer with 50 or more employees, and Minnesota Leave and Accommodation Laws applies to employees who work for employers with 21 or more employees. Approximately 20% of Minnesotans work for an employer with fewer than 21 employees. Approximately 83% of employers in the state. And therefore, they're not covered by either the Minnesota various leave laws or FMLA due to the employer size. Both the FMLA and the Minnesota law require the employee to have worked for the employer for at least 12 months in order to be eligible for leave. These stringent requirements also apply to the right to take employer-paid sick leave for the care of relatives or safety leave. Minnesota Supreme Court is currently considering whether the 12-month employment requirement applies to pregnancy accommodation rights. This proposal changes the parenting leave and accommodation law to reduce the employer size from 21 to one or more employees. the attachment requirement for pregnancy and parenting leave, as well as sick leave, are reduced from 12 months to 90 days, and the attachment requirement for pregnancy accommodation is clarified at 0 days. Next. The governor proposes amending the Women Economic Security Act of 2014 to better support lactation by ensuring employees can take time needed to pump at work without losing pay. Changes include requiring break time be paid, eliminating the ability for employers to opt out, and updating language to make the law more gender neutral. $84,000 in fiscal year 22 would be for outreach and education, and outreach and education to employers and employees on the law change, and $34,000 ongoing for enforcement and compliance activity. The ongoing $34,000 is 1% increase to the Labor Standards Division, which enforce labor laws. Current law requires reasonable unpaid break time for women to pump. However, the department proposed this break time be paid so employees don't have to make the difficult choice between getting paid or pumping breast milk at work. Labor and industry also propose removing language from the law that provides an opt-out for employers if providing break time would unduly disrupt the operations of the employer. Next. The governor proposes requiring employers to provide up to 80 hours of paid sick leave for healthcare providers to use for qualified COVID-19 related reasons. These critical frontline workers were frequently excluded from the paid leave provisions of the Federal Family First Coronavirus Response Act, which did not apply to employers with over 500 employees and allowed employers to exclude healthcare providers from eligibility for leave. All leave hours used by employees for qualified COVID-related reasons following enactment of this bill must be paid at the employee's regular rate of pay. The law would be in effect for the duration of the state peacetime emergency or June 30th, 2021, whichever occurs first. The department would be responsible for outreach and education of employers and employees on the law change and would have compliance and enforcement authority in addition to providing employees a private right of action. This proposal requires employees to provide up to 80 hours of paid time off to employees at the employee's regular rate of pay if the employee is unable to work or telework for the qualifying reasons. Next. This proposal aligns with the agency's statutory responsibility to adopt a model commercial energy code and consider amendments to the code to improve the efficiency of a building. The proposal recommends adoption of a new model commercial energy code when it is issued every 3 years, beginning with the adoption of the International ASRAE Standard 90.1. In 2019. Because the model code alone would likely be insufficient to achieve net zero by 2036, subsequent code adoptions would include an adjusted minimal percent efficiency or an equivalent set of enhancements to meet that goal. The agency anticipates this change to cost $145,000 every 3 years beginning in fiscal year 2023. $45,000 to conduct rulemaking and $100,000 to conduct a market and cost analysis to determine necessary energy efficiency performance enhancements. Next. The governor recommends reducing the annual $200,000 appropriation for the dual training competency grant from the Office of Higher Education base budget and adding it to Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry base budget beginning in fiscal year 2022. The dual training competency grant administered by the Office of Higher Education was established in 2015 to support the implementation of the Minnesota Dual Training Pipeline administered by the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Pipeline exists to support employers in creating and enhancing a competency-based dual training approach where workers receive a combination of related instruction strategically paired with on-the-job training. Dual training grants supplies the funding for the related instruction, and DLI provides added support to the Office of Higher Education in areas like outreach, grantee training, and monitoring. Additionally, labor and industry and the Office of Higher Education coordinate on maintaining a related instruction training provider inventory, which must be posted on our website. This inventory is maintained and hosted by labor and industry. Next. The governor recommends creating a Minnesota Family and Medical Leave Program administered by DEED. This program will provide wage replacement for family and medical leaves and will provide job protection for recipients so that they are assured of continued employment with their employer upon their return. Premiums collected will fund program benefits and ongoing administrative costs. Paid family and medical leave is a program that most employees will need at one point in their working career, but approximately 26% of all family and medical leaves do not include any wage replacement. According to the Paid Family and Medical Leave Insurance, options for designing and implementing a Minnesota program, which was released in February of 2016, around 10% of Minnesota workers take a family or medical leave in any given year. 59% of current leave in Minnesota are for one's own health reasons other than pregnancy. 17% are for bonding or parental leave, and 24% of the leave are for caretaking of a seriously ill family member. The majority of the program and the budget for this initiative, it will be under DEED. DLI would receive $1.046 million in fiscal year 2022 and 2023, and $1.086 million in fiscal year 23 to 25. For the Department of Labor and Industry for oversight and compliance costs related to the program, as well as the IT system upgrades. Next. The governor recommends earned sick and safe leave time to ensure working people have paid time to care for themselves or loved ones. It protects a parent from getting fired if, for example, their child gets sick during the middle of a shift. How much time to care is provided? 48 hours can be accrued per year and carried over. Employees would accrue hours that are paid by the employer. Earned sick and safe time and paid family and medical leave meet different needs for different families. It will allow workers to care for themselves and their families through day-to-day illnesses, emergencies, and snow days. Paid family medical leave provide for extended absences for major life events. It would allow workers to accrue 48 hours of paid time to care per year. It would provide 12 weeks per year of family leave and 12 weeks of medical leave. Earned sick and safe time covers short-term care in the form of hours or days of paid time to care when we get the flu for a couple days or a need to take a loved one to the doctor. Paid family medical leave would establish a state-administered insurance program to cover longer-term life events that affect all of us at some point in our careers, like bonding with a new child or supporting a loved one at the end of life. Both ensure that working people have paid time to care. There are two sides, really, of the same coin with different purposes. Together, they would ensure Minnesotans have paid time off to care for themselves or their loved ones. Next. Next, the governor recommends a $138,000 annual increase to the apprenticeship operating budget. The apprenticeship budget has not increased for quite some time. We make this request because we were fortunate enough to receive a federal grant back in 2017 that allowed us to hire an individual specifically to support and promote women and minorities entering into registered apprenticeship programs. This feature is a new area of support for labor and industry, and our sponsors indicate that this is a valuable service. We would like to see this work continue as Minnesota recover from COVID as well as into the future. Apprenticeship is our premier workforce development program. It is the one program that assures that individuals participating will earn a family-sustaining wage. Our sponsors need this support, and labor and industry is happy to provide this. However, we cannot do that with our current resources at hand. So we're asking for one FTE for an operating adjustment of $138,000. Next. The $3 million appropriation for the Workers' Comp IT Modernization Project included some contingency funds to be used if it was needed during the project. The project currently anticipates that we'll have approximately $700,000 unspent by June 30th of this fiscal year. We're asking that the department be allowed to continue to use these funds to continue to support campus as that program stabilizes. Next. That's it. That concludes my budget presentation. Thank you for your patience. And if there are questions, I will do my best to answer them. I also have invited some staff to assist if need be. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any member questions on the Commissioner's budget presentation? Seeing none, Commissioner, I appreciate the very thorough report, and we look forward to getting the omnibus Department of Labor bill put together here so we can hear it shortly after Easter recess. Members and staff, our next meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. At that time, we are planning on doing an overview and begin to take testimony on the Omnibus Veterans Affairs and Military Affairs Bill, Finance Bill. We do not have it ready yet, so the bill is not posted. So tomorrow will be the first rollout. We will have it ready. I plan on getting into members' hands so they can take a look at amendments and other things before our meeting on Friday. After Wednesday, we'll come back this Friday to continue testimony and take up any further discussion or debate on the bill. And then the plan of action is to send the bill to Ways and Means. Get that done before the Easter recess. Members, any questions before we adjourn? Seeing none, thank you for your time and paying attention today. We are adjourned.